friends, welcome back to Movies with Kane and Tal. It is hot, it is the beginning of December, and right now, pretty much the entire state of New South Wales, where Kane and I live, is on fire, literally on fire, bushfires raging everywhere. However, we carry on. We talk about the movies, and we bring you the talking about the movies. And today, we have a very special treat. Well, I think so. This is a Terry Gilliam double feature, and I will let Kane lead.
Hi, Kane.
We're sitting in Forestville, at the end of my bedroom, when the drugs began to take hold. Oh my god, yes! I think I just clipped the fuck out of the audio on that one.
But that's alright.
Yes! Oh my god, yes.
Okay, alright. So, for those at home who potentially haven't seen the movie and have got no idea what you're talking about, where are we?
We're doing Fear and Loathing in Las fucking Vegas.
We're in the Vegas desert, somewhere in Bat Country. Having a chat about two Terry Gilliam films.
We're going to be doing Fear and Loathing, and then we're going to get into The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. And hot damn, have I got a lot to say about both of them.
So let's just insert the trailer here so everybody can re-familiarize themselves with the film.
You want me to go to Las Vegas at once?
As your attorney, I advise you to rent a very fast car with no top. Tape recorder for special music. Get the hell out of L.A. for at least 48 hours.
We're all set. If I could just get you John Hancock, you're on your way.
Yeah.
Listen, you're going to be real careful with this car, right?
Oh, yeah, man.
Let's give the boy a lift.
We can't stop here. This is Bat Country.
Hot damn! I never rode in a convertible before!
Get out.
You can't park your car here.
Why not? Is this not a reasonable place to park?
Reasonable? You're on a sidewalk.
Wow. Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to start by saying I feel scarily comfortable watching these films, and I'm not sure what that says about me.
I have to admit, it's just, like, I've seen Fear and Loathing, like, so many times.
Me
I
too.
Think quotes from that thing have embedded themselves into my DNA. You're the ones who voted for Hubert Humphrey, and you killed Jesus! Just, oh my god, and I... In case I've been too subtle about it up until this point, I fucking love this movie. It is one of my all-time favorite movies. It is a fucking blast from beginning to end. Almost literally, considering how high energy this, like, this speed binge it is right from the start.
It's so intense. And normally a film like that would probably, like, if you presented the idea to me, I'd be like, oh, a couple of guys taking a bunch of drugs in Las Vegas is not really, doesn't sound like my cup of tea. But there's something about the way this film is made and how fucking hilarious it is. And I guess probably Johnny and Benicio's performances, which are just, I really, really hope to God there was not a lot of method acting going on there, because...
Well, I'm not entirely sure about method acting, but I do know that Johnny Depp did spend quite a lot of time with Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, right.
To get the role. To the point where Hunter S. Thompson appears in the film proper, like the scene in the club. Where it's like, holy shit, there's me! Stuff like that. And even to the point where, like, in pouring through Thompson's older writings, he actually, like, discovered an unreleased novel from the guy and helped it get published after his death.
Yeah.
And apparently Thompson, like, saw a lot of himself in the thing. Like, he was loving it, watching it for the initial test screening. And it's like, I totally get that, because as far as, like, drug movies go...
Mm.
This has to be one of the greatest of all time, because what Terry Gilliam and his cinematographer put together, they actively set out to make every scene feel like its own drug trip and put in, like, specific,
like
production ideas. Like, you know, for stuff like adrenochrome and LSD, speed, cocaine, amyl nitrate, 2 dozen amyls. It's just it's so confronting in places, because as very funny as it is, just watching Johnny Depp and Benicio Del Toro just like stumble around the moral car wash that is the morality car wash that is Las Vegas, it gets really intense at times, like the White Rabbit scene.
Yeah.
Dr. Gonzo wants Raoul Duke to kill him by throwing a radio into his bath.
Yeah.
And it's just like it actually got to the point where, like, watching it, it was that intense. It kind of triggered a form of like Requiem for a Dream reaction out of me, where it's like, it's that
visceral. It's so like,
I haven't tried most of the drugs depicted on here.
Good. So, don't do drugs. Drugs are bad.
So I can't really attest to accuracy, but it feels so intoxicating. I actively had to take breaks while watching it, because it's like, it got too heavy for me.
Yeah. The first couple of times I watched it, I felt like that. This time I felt like I was just revisiting some old friends.
It really is, because like the characters of like Raoul Duke and Dr. Gonzo, they're like so perfectly defined as just, what was the line? Too weird to live, too rare to die.
The
drugged out hippies of the 70s just trying to navigate
from on a hangover of a decade long, like, you know, almost countrywide drug binge. And the commentary on that through it as well. Always sort of reflecting back to that sort of period where it all kind of went wrong.
It's like right from the opening credits, which might be one of the scariest opening credits of all time. Just raindrops on roses. Oh my God, the Lennon sisters. Were they actively intending to make the scariest cover of a fucking Sound of Music song that they could, because they nailed it.
I'd say so.
And just like the blood splatter and all the, you know, the grainy like war protest footage is just like, it perfectly sets up the notion that basically you need drugs to survive Nixon's America, the Vietnam War era America.
Yeah.
The time when not only were the press considered the enemy of the state. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
But that kind of, like, not even pretending to be objective in regards to reporting was needed, because you needed that personal touch at a time when it felt like, well, you know, the conformity-insisting ways of capitalism were, like, pushing that out of the way. And that is ultimately what makes, because it's still effective today, Hunter S. Thompson's gonzo journalism as effective as it is. And honestly, it is a heavy inspiration on a lot of the stuff that I write. Like, when it got to the point of reviewing, what was it, the Vacation reboot thing that came out a few years ago, I was so broken mentally by watching that movie, I basically had to turn my story of watching it at the cinema into the review, like turn it into its own like gonzo narrative, like worrying that the audience was going to like choke me in my chair if I didn't laugh along with them, because I was the only person not laughing at that fucking movie for some reason. And it's just stuff like that. And there's also like, also one of my favorite comic books, Transmetropolitan, which is basically, what if Spider Jerusalem lived in a cyberpunk dystopia where it's like all the drugs are available, all the body altering tech is available, and the government is just as bad as ever? Which, yeah, again, massive influence on how I write. And just watching a movie, looking at this ostensibly insane cipher of a human being, like this person who realistically, considering how much, you know, substance abuse he undergoes, should not be vertical at any point in his lifetime.
Well, he was struggling a few times there.
Oh yeah. It's just like, especially when he like really got into the heavy stuff where he's just like Like, oh my god, the adrenochrome scene is fucking nightmarish.
It is very
in everywhere possible. Like,
yeah.
As soon as you see him take like one drop of it, it's like watching a friend eat hot sauce. It's like, you know what? I think you're good on the one drop there, and then you're just like drinking the bottle, and I'm like, oh no.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, Demon Gonzo. And the fucking room turning into this, like, neon nightmare. That's what really, like, surprised me about this. The way it was able to, like, channel the very neon-heavy lighting of the Las Vegas Strip and turn that into something to be terrified of. Like, it's very difficult to make really garish neon lighting scary in its own way, but this absolutely nailed it. It is, like, it is as funny in places as it is deeply unsettling in others. Like, for every scene where, like, Dr. Gonzo is having all the difficulty getting off a carousel dining room, there's stuff like the bathtub scene or the imagined court trial where Christina Ricci is, like, you know, the little, little innocent girl going to, you know, testify.
Let's pimp her out to the cops. And
they gave me LSD.
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh my god, the fucking police convention where they talk about the dangers of marijuana, which was definitely, like, an underpinning for the entire film. It's like, you've got these guys doing, like, the hardest stuff possible. Like, right down to the point where they started, like, I think, joking about, like, chewing on, like, a torn out adrenal gland from another human being.
Yeah.
And all these people are worried about pot.
I know.
It's like,
that's such a great, just, I'm trying to think of that. It just sort of sums up the exact whole issue with drugs always and always has been, you know, that there's this complete and utter misunderstanding throughout the government and the police force of drugs at all. And then these two guys are sitting there in the audience and they're talking about marijuana and they're like, they've taken about 60 different tons of substances and they're sweating and carrying on.
Even though I have seen this film so many times before, I honestly was a little surprised that they didn't throw in a reference to the pot needle. Just to really nail home how much these guys know fuck all about what they're talking about.
Exactly. It was just, yeah. What I find interesting is, and I guess it's probably common with these kind of, I put this in the genre of a cult film in a lot of ways, and also particularly because Hunter S. Thompson has his own cult following. And I guess I'm interested when for some reason I looked it up, online, and it's very middling with, you know, popular opinion. It falls in the very kind of, you know, Rotten Tomato. It doesn't matter which one you look at, IMDb, it doesn't matter. It falls in a very kind of mid-range thing. And I wondered if that's were the hardcore Hunter S. Thompson fans, like, not impressed with it, or is it just that most people just literally didn't get it?
It could be some combination of the two, along with, considering director Terry Gilliam's career has pretty much been, like, flooded with these kinds of, you know, love him or hate him features.
We should probably point out he was one of the founding members of Monty Python, so there you go.
Yeah.
If ever there was a divisive, moment in time.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell that kind of influence, especially when it gets to the club scene where the reptile room.
Yes.
Like, just, someone's giving booze to these bastards. It's just stuff like that. But Terry Gilliam, in regards to Fear and Loathing, actually said that he wants it to be considered either one of the great movies of all time or one of the most hated movies of all time.
Well,
and that pretty much meters out the response it got, because...
Totally. And also, you know, when Hunter S. Thompson first released this as a book, and it was based on two trips that he'd done himself, and it was kind of, you know, a little bit autobiographical in that way, and he was making a lot of commentary on, you know, America, Vietnam War, the drug haze, all that kind of stuff. his contemporaries and a lot of the critics at the time panned it. And a few people came out and said, this will be one of the most, you know, the most important pieces of literature of modern times.
Which it is.
Which it is and has proven to be. Simply because there really isn't anything that I know of that touches it that deeply. And I think that that's a problem for some Americans if they don't like...
It really is a genre all of its own, because even though it is a...
He is Hunter S. Thompson is a genre of his own.
Yes, it's like... And even though this movie can easily fit into, you know, like, dark comedy, like, you know, satirical...
Sure.
Drug movie... There really isn't that much out there that's like it.
No.
Like being able to properly, not just like simulate the effects of drugs to the point where it feels like you need to come down from just watching it.
Trainspotting?
Even that didn't go this far. In my opinion, like Trainspotting, like really did well in regards to treating, with the main characters treating other people as the drug, almost, like they're using people like other people would use substances. But with this, it was like...
There's no morality tale in Fear and Loathing. It's not a don't do drugs movie, whereas Trainspotting kind
of
is.
It really isn't. To the point where it does make a point of, you know, highlighting the people who see drugs as the major issue and seeing them, like, go after what is... Probably the least harmful drug that's actually put in there.
Alcohol is worse than...
Yeah, exactly. And they actually give lip service to that in the movie. The idea that, like, you know, Nixon's America is just so fucking awful that you need substances to get through it. Whether it's smoking or, like, regular smoking, like we saw with the guy on the stage at the police convention. It's like...
Just change
puffing away. And there's people in the bar who are like, who are drinking. And
the massive beer bellies on all of the cops. Like, you can tell that these are the kinds of guys who go home after work, drink like a six pack of beer, probably smoke a packet of cigarettes, and think there's nothing wrong with that, but yeah, they're going to go to a convention based entirely on, oh my God, marijuana.
It reminds me of an old Robin Williams routine where he's talking about, like this old couple who are drinking like 8 cups of coffee, 12 cigarettes. Like, your mother and I never did drugs. Like, yeah, sure.
Exactly.
And as far as like cultural commentary, it is really weird thinking about like what that, you know, the hippie generation would turn into, because,
yeah.
and this is something that I really like about filmmakers like, what's his name? Panos Cosmatos. He deals in a lot of, you know, commenting on, you know, the hippie generation and stuff like that. And it's really weird thinking about how, like, these, free love, free sex, free drugs people would become the Reaganites of the 80s. The people who take that same willingness to experiment with drugs and basically, like, reverse engineer, the opiate problem that is only becoming more and more of an issue in America.
Yeah.
Like, even as we're talking here, it's a very affecting movie. And just, as far as just like experience, because those make for like the best movies for me, the ones where you can just sit down and. It kind of feels like from what little experience I've had in regards to like substance use, it really does feel
or
like
abuse.
it does kind of like ring true to at least what I understand of the thing, where it feels like everything's just like floating past your brain, and it's like you don't almost like you're an observer to what's happening around you, and it.
Look, I'm not going to say anything to incriminate myself here, but I spent a lot of time working in hospitality, and I spent time with, I think that's partly why I feel comfortable watching this movie and it feels like I'm hanging out with old friends, because I've spent time with people whose weekends were regularly looked a little similar to that. Not quite to that extent, not quite to throwing... tape players in baths and not to wading through...
And strapping microphones to your head with, like, the tape player on the front.
Wading through knee-deep water in your hotel suite or anything like that. But, yeah, there is... it rings very true, and I think that that's probably made a lot of people really uncomfortable if they ever have experienced drugs like that, and particularly if they've ever seen anybody experience drugs like that and they didn't like how their lives turned out, those people, it can be quite, from that perspective, it can probably be quite confronting. I have a fairly loose moral standing on drugs. I just feel like people should just do what, as long as they're not hurting anybody else, just, you know.
And what was this, when you take into account stuff like, you know, tobacco and alcohol, and not to mention stuff that gets legally prescribed. Like,
right, we've just been having a conversation about some of the stuff that you can ask your doctor to give you, and I'm telling you.
it really is a matter of just, like, whatever you need to cope with the fucking dismal state that is the world in any generation.
Yeah. If you're not hurting anybody else, you know, go for it, mate.
There's that as well. And yeah, and I honestly do understand why this film still to this day kind of gets a mixed response, because I do understand that there is a certain mentality when it comes into going to see a movie, where if it makes you feel bad, it is bad, or like this complete aversion to anything that makes you, like, you know, feel something that isn't, like, cathartic.
Which is what happened to me with Requiem with a Dream for a Dream. It made me feel so bad, I couldn't say that I liked it as a film, whereas I probably look back now, 10 years later, and go, actually, it was a fucking amazing film. I just couldn't say that or feel that at the time, because I came out of it feeling, well, almost suicidal.
Yeah, it is a very traumatizing movie, and it does mark one of the only movies that I actively think is one of the greatest movies of all time. But I'll be fucked if I could ever watch it again.
Yeah, God, no.
Whereas with this, even though it does evoke similar reactions in regards to just how, like, cutting it is in regards to depicting the effects of drugs.
It's so rewatchable.
It really is, because
it's like a trip. It's like going on a trip.
It's so endlessly quotable. Like, everything about the movie. Like,
oh, that's good writing for you.
Right down from, like, from how overwhelming bright lights big city Las Vegas is, to the fact that in all the desert shots there's no horizon anywhere, so it's like it stretches out forever. I'm the kind of person who, if a film, like, affects me to the point where I actively do feel somewhat suicidally depressed, I actually consider that to be a good thing. Like, with stuff like Requiem for a Dream or Where the Dead Go to Die, or even Una. All those movies, first time watching them, left me fucking miserable out of my goddamn mind. Mm. But because they felt, A, like they, well, wanted that reaction out of me.
Yeah.
But also totally, because it had a reason for getting that reaction out of me.
Yeah.
I consider those to be genuinely great films that I'm a bit iffy about watching for another time. Because the reaction is that intense,
don't
that
go through it again.
Thing I can't really put my finger on, I suppose, just in regards to just, like, making you just feel.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, you're right. That is the mark of a good film. If it's made you feel something, then it meant to make you feel that thing, then it's achieved its purpose. So let's talk then on that point, especially because the desert reminded me of the next film we're going to talk about, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. And cue trailer.
I am the man for whom all dangers are expressly reserved.
Good God, Sancho! A giant!
Prepare
to die!
I am Don Quixote de la Mancha.
Help!
Esto se ha roto! Speak in English!
And cut right there. Good work.
Estaba aquí 10 años. Hacía una película pequeña.
No, you're angry.
The girl is in danger.
You are Don Quixote.
You will be safe with my squad.
I am Don Quixote.
Yep, the film nearly three decades in the making. The pinnacle of Terry Gilliam's status as one of the most cursed filmmakers to walk the earth. Like, how to put it, did you ever watch Chase's War on Everything back in the day? All right, do you remember that bit about Terry Gilliam doing a brand power ad and, like, moving on? Well, that was one of the gags that they did on that. It was, like, this whole thing of, like, Johnny Depp got killed, they tried to replace him with a camel. all of the, I don't know, it was a cow, actually, if I remember correctly. And, like, a freak storm blew it all away. All of that was basically referencing the troubled production of Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Oh.
And it really was that chaotic. There's a reason why this has taken, like, nearly 30 years to get off the ground, because Terry Gilliam, along with, like, really struggling to find funding for the thing, because pretty much, like, a bulk of his movies bomb at the box office, even though critics and audiences tend to love the hell out of them.
Yeah, why is that always such a marker? Like,
yeah, it really does make you feel bad for the guy at times, especially with how, like, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, the version we officially get, it really does feel like he's tapping into something personal with it. Like, it is easily one of his most personal films, and it really feels like that all the time he poured into trying to make the film a reality and all the time bringing everyone else in to try and help make it a reality, it really felt like it did a number on him. Like, this is really self-loathing on his part. Like, this is him really, like, fixating on the idea that he brought all of these people along for the ride and just, like, you know, just, like, put them into, you know, mentally compromising states, physically compromising positions, and just
financially,
and all that fear about putting all that time, effort, misery, blood, sweat, tears, possible semen at the end of the day, just pouring all that into a movie that, well, much like Dan Gilroy with Superman Lives, might never be completed. All this work trying to embody the idea of fantasy imposing its will on reality, like the original Don Quixote, and it just remaining a fantasy, which is kind of tragic in its own way, which is why it is really gratifying to see, regardless of anything else, this film completed, because it really gives the impression that this is something Terry Gilliam needed to finish.
Okay, well, that's really interesting, because I didn't watch it with that frame of reference because I wasn't aware of that. I haven't closely followed Terry Gilliam's career other than, you know, knowing the obvious facts. And so I just sat down to watch it because it was the film that you told me to watch for this podcast. And I started watching it and I was so tired that I got 10 minutes in and I went to bed. And then the next night my husband watched it without me. And the following day we were driving and he said, gave me his kind of, how he felt about it, what he thought about it. And he really didn't enjoy it very much and really didn't kind of get it. And so I went a few days later and sat down to watch it. And I thought, oh, I hope this isn't disappointing. I really don't want to waste 2 hours of my life watching this film, you know. And then I'm like, this is great. Like, really great.
Yeah.
And then it got better and better and better and better. And he said he could have sort of followed the story, and I was like, it's actually not that hard to follow. But I was kind of expecting, I think I was expecting something more weird and more surreal than what I ended up seeing. So, and also because I think I'm quite comfortable in that genre of film, as we've just discussed. And again, I don't know what that says about me, but I really...
It says
really
you have taste.
Thank you. I thought it was very funny, and I thought it really said something, and something important, and something that I've been feeling myself at the moment with what we've been doing, in that sort of, I feel like I've dragged you into this thing, and now I'm getting these kind of feels, you know, sometimes I have these moments where I'm like, what if it all comes to nothing, you know? And not that it's quite to the extent that, you know, Terry Gilliam has gone through with trying to get a film off the ground for 30 years. But I totally got that from it without knowing that frame of reference that you just told me.
And, well, that's the mark of a good movie. And there is definitely something to be said about, like, the notion that Terry Gilliam, with this movie, had to see it completed, because he's not the kind of filmmaker like Dan Gilroy who's able to turn that level of artistic frustration at an unfinished product into its own form of art.
Mm-hmm.
Or even someone like Orson Welles, who also had difficulty making his own Don Quixote movie, who had, like, this big estate set up and all, you know, like a fan base devoted enough to see his movies completed because Mm-hmm. One of his unfinished films actually did get finished last year with The Other Side of the Wind, which is another movie that feels like it needed to see completion just to see, make it all come together. But Terry Gilliam isn't that kind of filmmaker. As described to me by a friend of my blog, Diamanda Hagen, another film reviewer who actually gave me my first podcast bit, she described Terry Gilliam as the kind of person who would get into genetic engineering just so his version of Lord of the Rings would have real orcs in it. Like, that's how far this guy goes. There's a reason why his productions always go over budget, always see, like, you know, diminished returns, because it's really difficult to, like, equal out just how ambitious the guy is. Uh-huh. And looking at stuff like Lost in La Mancha, the documentary that was made about the initial failed attempt to make this movie, and seeing all the stuff to do with, like, forced perspective and, like, arrays of, like, giant puppets all over the place, it's like, you know, wonder this didn't work. This is, like, all over the place. And admittedly, part of me is always going to be curious about if that version of the movie came into being, because it is markedly different. Like, for one, the main character is still
Toby,
the advertising executive. But rather than going back in time, it's just him making a Don Quixote movie for the second time, because back when he was all wide-eyed and idealistic and, you know, the real artist, he did it as a student project, and the effects it had on the people who were involved, like, bloody hell, Don Quixote himself, like Jonathan Pryce, in one of his best collabs with Terry Gilliam, like up there with Brazil. Mm. Like, just seeing this really tragic figure who just, like, completely gives in to the fantasy that he is this great knight errant.
Mm.
It's really disquieting in its own way. It's like, it's like, even though, like, his visions of the world can occasionally reach the levels of the freakishly insane, like with the bit when he's looking at the pig carcasses and suddenly, like, they get, like, massive eyes and mouths, and it's just, the fuck, is this Fear and Loathing Part 2? It's just, it's just,
have a bit of that.
Hang on, it's really damn hot out today. I need to grab my towel.
There's a real, you know, in society in general, the elderly are almost, you know, as maligned and ignored as, you know, the mentally ill and the poverty stricken. And
so when you intersect all three of them, it's a real tough situation.
Really, really. And it's I love a movie that makes you think about stuff like that and can kind of touch those points for you without dragging you into some kind of Requiem of a Dream suicidal tendency area. And not that it feels at all like he's just brushing over this stuff, and that it's not, what would you say? There's going to be a big long pause here that I'm going to have to edit out of this thing. He's not just brushing over it. It is very deep. The themes are really looked into properly. It's just not dragging you into, you know, that kind of...
Yes, it's like, even like as you went into it, not knowing the production history, this script still feels like the product of someone rethinking the same idea over and over and over in their heads for years, because it is very heady. Like, like, it brushes on certain aspects, like the notion that the guy playing the shoemaker, who plays Don Quixote, him basically being, like, you know, exploited, like the mentally ill guy that's exploited for everyone else's surface level gratification, which, hello, Hollywood, you've been doing that for decades.
Exactly.
And there's even a bit of almost Al Bundy style, you know, look at his character and the idea that it's like, his life sucks that much that he like retreats into his own 15 minutes of fame because it's almost David Fincher in its own way in how it looks at Christopher Nolan in the way that it looks at, you know, the really compelling lie and how it looks so much more attractive than a really heartbreaking truth.
Yeah, yeah. And I really enjoyed the... So what's the main character? Who is that? I know it's the guy from Star Wars.
Adam Driver.
Adam Driver, right, right. So his Toby's character arc is beautiful. I really, really loved it. You could really see the change in him, the realization, and it wasn't smack you over the head with it. It was subtle, but it was there, and it was like really beautiful. And I think for me, the whole film, and it's not the kind of film that I expected to describe as beautiful, but it is a beautiful film.
It really is. It's just again, much like the script, the way it looks feels like it was really labored over, especially when it gets to like the really opulent moments, like with the big costume party that everyone's going to, and it's just like they set up that big like that mock horse just to show them like you're going to the moon and like all this other stuff. It again, exploitation.
Yeah.
And getting back to Toby, he's like looking at him even without taking the production history into effect, it really is easy to see him as an avatar for the actual director, especially with the way that he keeps talking about like, who wrote this scene? And all this stuff. And that one moment where it's like he's having the conversation with someone else in Spanish, and then he literally pushes the subtitles away and just goes, we can talk in English, it's fine.
Yeah,
we don't need the rules here.
Yeah.
And the idea of, well, you know, you become what you hold on to, one of the earlier lines in the film really latches onto it. And it not only explains, you know, Toby's motivations throughout the whole thing, it really tells a lot about Terry Gilliam's, because it really feels like he found his kindred spirit with the Don Quixote story, because all of Terry Gilliam's films in their own way have been about the way that fantasy influences reality, whether that fantasy be the American dream with Fear and Loathing, the idea that one good guy can crush capitalism forever with Brazil, or even just the idea that films need proper resolution, like with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which has one of the most famous non-endings of any movie.
I was watching The Meaning of Life the other day, and I was just...
Still my favourite Monty Python movie.
So we cannot go there, because that's a whole non-podcast.
And The Crimson Permanent Assurance as well, directed also by Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, right.
And...
Oh, man.
And there is something, like, tragically inspirational about the idea that he clings so hard to Don Quixote, especially when Don Quixote himself is someone who is so influenced by fiction, because the whole background for his character is that he spent so long reading, like, romantic, medieval, like, fantasy stories that he believed himself to be one of those characters.
Yeah.
And through, like, trying to bring his story to life, Terry Gilliam feels... it feels like he's trying to tap back into an era where, like heart and bravery is what made people go down to legend, not perpetual failure, which Terry Gilliam seems to have gone through. Because it's not like Don Quixote's the only time that things didn't work out for him. Same thing with Baron Munchausen, same thing with Jabberwocky, same thing with Brazil. Hell, even some elements of Fear and Loathing went through the same thing.
Right.
And, yeah, I know that I'm getting back into my auteur theory shit where, you know, the director is the main creative force. But when you're dealing with a film that's, like, almost 30 years in development, primarily off the basis of him imposing his will on making it work,
for sure.
It feels like it works. That and auteur theory seems to be the thing that comes most easily for me when it comes to critique, so I'm going to fucking go with it.
Fair enough. Yeah, and again, I'm going to use the word beautiful, but beautiful to think that this story from the very early, you know, 1604, I mean, like, here we have this kind of hundreds of years later, beautiful, look back and draw into a completely new modern kind of morality tale all over again with the whole fantasy and reality and stuff, and that's extraordinary.
Especially with how Gilliam and his co-writer, I think it was Toby Grissoni, the guy he co-wrote the script with.
Yeah.
The way they actually went into how, like, not entirely making Don Quixote pitiable and actually highlighting why, like, someone, however misguided, you know, that kind of, like, knight errant, almost sure. like the original superhero kind of thing, was needed considering everything happening to do with, like, you know, religious persecution and all this, like, you know, society sucks. We need some level of fantasy to get through it. That's it's right. like, how to put it, Don Quixote is the opiate of the masses, almost.
Yeah, yeah. No, for sure.
If that's not too poncy for me to say.
No, not at all. And it's good to have a chat about it because it's the kind of film that you need to talk about, I think. You know, it's not one of those ones, you know, I don't know, I'll put out there, murder mystery. Probably doesn't need to talk to anybody about except
didn't even need to bring it up again.
I know, but I'm so angry. No, I'm just kidding. but it is. It's so good to talk about a movie like this, and I hope that, I hope Terry's happy, and I hope that, you know, if he ever listens to this or hears anybody, you know, being able to have a conversation about it, that what it has done, that it's opened a conversation and that it was worth finishing it. It was just, you know,
awesome. And that's the main thing I walked away from this film with, other than I think it's really, really fucking good.
Yeah.
Just, I really hope that all that time, all that effort, all that just blood that he poured into this movie, I really hope that now it has actually seen through fruition, that the man gets some well-earned peace of mind about the whole situation.
Yeah.
Because it can't be easy dealing with something that big, especially when, like, when a production drags on for that long, the build-up of its own anti-hype becomes part of the actual hype for the thing. Like, this film took 30 years to create! Is it worth that much time?
Yeah.
Like, that can kill a movie dead
before
it even gets a chance to get up and walk finally.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, it's, you know, I hope, well, people will have watched it before they listen to this, hopefully. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit ruined for you. But, yeah,
I don't think we have to worry too much about that, considering the title is its own spoiler.
True. You don't really...
In its own way.
There's not really anything to spoil this movie. It is, and if you haven't seen it, it's so worth watching. And if you haven't seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, go and see it. But first of all, if you've never seen a Monty Python film, that's where you need to start. At the beginning.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then you might, you know, get it.
Yeah.
So, we'll wrap this up, because I'm going to have to get out of here today. I've got to get back.
Right.
People to see, things to do, children to pick up.
There's only so much time we can spend talking about awesome things.
Oh, I don't know. I can do that. just to be honest. Well, thank you once again.
Right then.
That was a great film.
I'll try not to hurt your hands.
Thank you. That's it, folks. Thank you once again for joining us. There'll be an extra special episode on Friday, a for Friday's sake, FFS episode. And then we will return with our regular programming on Wednesday as per usual. Look forward to talking to you then. Bye for now.